welcome you to the second session of our conference on intergroup education. We are very much indebted to the person who's going to preside over this meeting today, not only for being chairman, but also having such a major part in the organization of this conference. I'm happy to introduce the chairman of the afternoon, Dr. John Adair.
Thank you. I think it would be well to get underway, and then I'm sure others will be joining us during the afternoon, including one of our panelists. Mr. Othiano is not here as yet, but we will expect him soon. First of all, would like to simply say that with Dr. Skinner's remarks last night, and his really very eloquent speech, I should say, I think we have a bit more of a feeling of the modern political situation, the modern social situation, and the a good idea of what being living in West Africa today means, and how that has been perceived by an American Negro who visited the Ivory Coast this last summer with a group of American Negro and white college-aged children. What we'd like to do this afternoon now is to develop the interchange, this, as we've labeled it on our leaflet, New Horizons in Education, which are opened up by these new political movements in Africa, the independence of many of the nations from their colonial heritage, and see what we have to offer Africans who have come to America to study, and what we in turn have to present to them when we go to their country. I'd like now to introduce the members of this afternoon's panel. On my left is Mr. Albert Opoku, a fellow with the Rockefeller Foundation, who is here studying at the Martha Graham School, studying modern dance forms, and studying dance notation, music notation too, I believe, at the Juilliard School, and who hopes to carry back Western influence to Ghana, where he has seen many of the dances which are taken part in as part of the daily life of the people, many of them passing away, and presenting these in perhaps more in as a self-conscious art form. Mr. Opoku is also an artist and has studied in London in the graphic arts, and in his country has been a teacher of the graphic arts. Mrs. Dudley Moore, my other side, is not, as the program unfortunately says, do a slip in constructing the program, is not with the Friends Service Committee, but is with the Unitarian Service Committee, and has for many years been concerned with developing community leaders, community development generally speaking. I've known her for many years for her very significant work among the Navajo Indians, where the Unitarian Service Committee, in collaboration with the Navajo tribe and with various with foundation support, has run a very has made a great contribution to the integration of Navajo people with the community of Gallup and in developing recreation and educational programs there, right on the edge of the Navajo reservation. Ms. Wall is a librarian here in the city of New York, is the director of a library, as announced in the program, in the Bronx. Was in West Africa and in Ghana included in 1959, At the present time, she is chairman of a committee which is organizing a bibliography for young adults on Africa for the American Library Association. Ms. Moore is the fourth grade teacher at the New Lincoln School, one of the other schools, as all of you were aware, in New York City, which has much the same philosophy, I would say, as the downtown community school in terms of intergroup education. Ms. Moore will speak of what she is doing in the classroom here and will relate this to what she, to the rest of the comments made by the members of the panel. Ms. Mimi Cooper-Levy is a author and, as you see in your leaflets, has been working on a number of novels, a number of books for young American children on African themes. I hope, too, Ms. Levy, that you will say a few words about your writing and the whole subject of Africa and how you are presenting this to your audience. Mr. Othiano, and our last panelist is Mr. Othiano, who is a teacher, is taking a doctorate in international education at Columbia Teachers College. Mr. Othiano has studied at in London, the University of London, where he was a pupil of the well-known anthropologist and educator Margaret Reed, among others. Mr. Othiano is from Kenya and is in the civil service in Kenya and will be returning to Kenya to carry on educational work there. I think that we will follow the order on the program as far as presentations go, so Mr. Opoku will start, and then Mr. Othiano, and then the other members of the panel. Mr. Opoku.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am very pleased to be here this afternoon, and I would like very much to congratulate the sponsors of this very timely conference for their forethought in organizing this body of opinion from Africa and America to scan new horizons in education. It is my earnest wish and hope that other fields can be so explored by the experts in those fields for a better understanding and interchange of ideas for our mutual benefit. We in Africa believe that the central goal of education is intellectual, spiritual, cultural, physical development. We further agree that the act of learning is a complex process, just as is set down in the beliefs of this school. We believe that it involves the acquisition of information and experience, the development of skills, and the expression for the creative thinking and living. At this time when emergent Africa is scanning new horizons and seeking to be known and loved, it is encouraging to know that children in this school are being given opportunities to learn in depth about the life and cultures of other people of the world, combining this knowledge of others with feeling. The Africa of yesterday has so much to teach the Africa of today and the world of today. For to our forefathers, life itself was a creative force which expressed itself in creative thinking, religion, music, the plastic arts, language arts, and the arts of the body and body movement or gesture. The nearest picture that I would be very familiar to you is the picture of the Renaissance man, because that is the African concept of a properly balanced African person, properly brought up, who is an embodiment of the experiences, discoveries, and thoughts, and creative expressions of his time. During contact with Western ideas, which changed all this, much has been lost, and Africa today is in the process of re-examining its past to find what it can salvage and to select what it can use to give it an expression of its own individual self, and also to offer it as its contribution to world knowledge and culture. I would like to explain at this point that we do not think that the influences which tended to put our cultural and creative activities in the background was a deliberate policy. Most of the time when the colonial powers came over, they had a difficulty in getting personnel and in starting schools and training people to take over office jobs and so on. They broke a certain type of pattern in the lives of the people and did not have much time themselves to find out much about our way of life, and perhaps unconsciously destroyed some things. That is why for us in Africa today, we gaze on the new horizons before us. In opening the discussion on the creative expressions of Africa, I will seem to wander into several other fields, but this is because, as I have already expressed, to us, life itself is an art form. We feel that a properly balanced person should have all those things, and we're not very much in tune with the modern tendency in the West where everything has been categorized and there is such a strong emphasis on the specialist. To make things simpler, I would like to take as an example the training of an African in the creative arts. Somebody who is very familiar to you because you've seen more of African sculpture than I think of any other African form of art. For my example, I'll take the wood carver in an African society. The wood carver or sculptor. As a child, like most other people, he would most naturally be exposed and imperceptibly taught to recognize rhythm, which is the essence of life. To amuse a baby, very often you'll find a mother making up rhythm sounds, sounds of drums like tam tam tam, tam tam tam, tam tam tam, and while he's doing that, may rock the child like this, bounce bounce, and then incline. Just go tam tam tam, tam tam tam. As soon as you stop it and you say tam tam tam, you find the child following up and doing that. That is at the same time making him rhythm conscious and also teaching coordination. Or in your terms here, you might say one and two, one and two, one and two, which is something which I've learned here as your way of counting. I've heard some other things which with my English education I found very difficult, but I'm trying hard. Very soon the baby begins to express itself to rhythmic stimuli of all sorts, and even to kick and gesture to clapping sounds. And I'd like to explain to at this point that most African languages are tonal, and they've got their disadvantages. Because they've got a tonal structure, very often three ceilings. If you call one word and you lower your voice to the wrong ceiling, it can mean something completely different. A typical example is the word la, spelled L-A. If you say la, it means sing. But if you say la, it means fire. And another picture of it, I'm giving an example from another tribe deliberately. I can't make the other sound, but it's still the same la. If you don't pitch it quite right, it means blood. And at another pitch, it also means to dream. But it's got its advantages in that when we talk, you have a very happy rhythmic flow of words, and it makes it quite natural for the old people to insist that people learn the art of language. And typical in this context is the a short lullaby here, which I'd like to repeat to you. Amali is the name of a girl. And you'll find a mother trying to calm down, a baby was crying, and you just say, Amali, sunkitinkiti. Amali, sunkitinkiti. Ubema unanabe bumi, unanakwa bunabe bumi. Amali, sunkitinkiti. You just listen to that. Ta 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 ta. It's nothing more than the beat of the drum. It's in our blood, it's in our life. The whole life is to us. The whole world to us is music, it's rhythm. Life, the life cycle is made up of rhythms, and we start with it from infancy. That's why you notice when I talk, I use my hands a lot. I think my friend over there, when he starts talking, we'll be doing exactly the same kind of And very often when you find one woman doing that to a child, any other people who are there will just pick up this simple rhythm, Amale sunkitinkiti, Amale sunkitinkiti. They will be just singing that all the time while the other one is singing the other as a sort of melody at the top, so that you get a double line. I will refer to that in a short time again. As the child grows up, more exercises are devised to train his senses for rhythm in dancing, drumming, and the beauty of the spoken word, and the correct posture and poise. When you're very young, as soon as they see you can walk properly and go to fetch water, they give you a small size pot. They put it on your head, they go to fetch water. You've got to have the correct posture, otherwise you will drop the pot. Just by that sort of means, you begin to feel. Some of it is certain words, sometimes it is made of calabash, but you soon learn how to do that. And there are all sorts of activities in which we get training in the proper coordination of the body. And what is more, when you come back in the evening, sundown, when everything is finished, you'll find the old people with no drums there imitating the sound of drums with voices and clapping and getting the toddlers to come up there and dance. It's an inconsequential tool. They're not trying to teach any particular kind of dance. They're just trying to see their response to rhythm. And he is also exposed to situations where he can observe and learn from experts at dance festivals, meetings. When you go to meetings, like a meeting of chiefs, then you find out the true meaning of language, because very often you go up to a place and they speak your own language, it's in plain words, and you do not understand. My friend over here has got used to a few things. We were once going to some place and we were in a bit of a, at least we were a bit late, and he kept running me off my feet, and I turned around and put in English something which was appropriate, and that was this: if a friend of yours dashes his foot against a stone and falls down and dies, if you're going to his funeral, you do not run. That's the typical sort of thing which you will learn to use quite freely in Africa. And you will find very often people talking and talking in that kind of stream, where you've got to do a bit of thinking to get at what they are trying to say. A typical example is this. A friend of mine was done down very badly by somebody in whom he had a great deal of trust, and unfortunately for the person, he also fell in disgrace. And when I met my friend, he said, "That which made the top of the vulture's head bald has done a similar thing to the backside of the monkey." that sort of thing. And before you cross, you say, don't insult the crocodile. Certainly not until after you've crossed the river. That kind of language. is something which we bandy around quite freely, and sometimes there are competitions in that, in expressing those ideas and indulging. And you can sit down, especially when you meet these, the English have got a word, linguist, but a linguist means a different thing in Western terms, but this one is more or less the voice or the spokesman for the tribe. I think it's also true of Kenya. We all, like the English, believe that the king can do no wrong. In order to be logical, when the king has made a statement, to put it in our terms, you have not heard until this person puts it in diplomatic language. And they're so good, they will say a whole lot of things so very nice that you don't know what they're talking about. The reason is this: since the king does no wrong, if anything happened, the king will say that he didn't say it, it was the spokesman who said it. So to protect himself, he had to learn his words properly, to use words with double meanings, to bring in a lot of these old precepts. And if he's a very clever person, he will state just a few words, pose that as a question. You see, usually these forms have got two sides. It starts with a first part and a second part. He will state the first part as a question, and then drop in and says, but wisely have the elders said that it is only to the intelligent that you explain the whole of the proverb, and the others will not. They may not understand what he is getting at, but it doesn't do to show you are ignorant of the language. See, they all nod, and he sails along very nicely. But to get back to our child learning wood carving, he's been exposed to all these things. When he's old enough to work with his hands, he's given not toy tools, but real tools made to fit his hand. If his father uses a certain chisel, he is given a small chisel as a, I think it was Professor Chizek said, the child is not a miniature adult. And that is quite true in teaching these skills. Just take the child at his own level and give him things which he can use. And they are taught to use the thing properly. The father doesn't make it a sort of formal education. He will just be carving. You find the child doing exactly the same thing. Exactly. From time to time, the child will say, look what I've done. He said, that's very nice, but I would do this. And then he'll cut one point and said, you hold it now, and do a cut here. And said, now go on. But by that sort of means, he begins to get him used to learning how to cut against the grain to get a good clean cut and not split the wood. Bit by bit, the child begins to get a bit more skillful. When he has advanced far enough to be able to cope with subjects, then the really interesting part begins to come in, because the woodcarver, I've noticed in, or for that matter, all the African artists I've met, tend to approach their subject from a mood point of view. It is subjective, and it's at the same time emotive. And to drive that into the child, I've seen it very often. For example, we have big umbrellas with chiefs, which are put on top of on chiefs, and to distinguish that this is the chief of so-and-so with, well, what you might call his regimental colors. You carve a piece and stick it on the top of the umbrella so that when he's coming at a distance, he can be recognized. One of the most important of these symbols is what they call the war horn in my tribe. And I watched a woodcarver teaching a young child to carve this particular thing. And it's very simple thing, except that it's beautifully proportioned and it's in a curve. And I didn't see how he was going to get this thing worked out with that kid. But he started off by telling me that we're going to carve this horn, and he started carving on the other side, and the boy was carving, and then he reenacted the historical event, during which the Ashanti people captured this particular war horn. But what was most interesting was how he made a very vivid picture just by painting words and singing and that is the sound of the war drum of a certain regiment, and said, and then they answered it here, and then you heard ta 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 ta, that is the horn of another group. And the child was made to go into that battle, to be in it in spirit and in mood, and out of it he was able to feel as he was intended to feel and to carve the piece of work. The object here is to make his son feel and to put his feelings into his into the carving of the war horn. But when you have trained as a carver, that is not the end of it. I think it's true of my part of the world, at least for West Africa, and I think for the most part of Africa. You are then sent to live perhaps for 2 years or 3 years with another relation to learn a further skill from that relation. If you learn wood carving, it is not enough, because this particular emblem which they put on top of umbrellas are sometimes decorated with gold leaf gilding, and it's a wood carver's job to learn that one. To do that, he might go to an uncle, stay with the uncle, be an apprentice there, and learn how to do that. He might be asked to carve drums. He must know something about drums, because it's a very complicated process carving a drum. He just takes a tree trunk. When he's got everything right, he's then got to use an axe. You know, the fork of a tree. It just comes out, it's cut at this point until it's a V shape. Then this part is cut shorter. Then a broad chisel, which got a hole at the top, sort of like that. It's put there like that. And that is the main tool for carving. You hold the long side and then chip away. To get that and a hollow log, it takes some doing, but they do it. And to see that the thickness is even all the way through, you will find him just chip a bit in there, and then with a piece of wood, he will tap it and listen for sound. Just tapping all around. When he has found that it produces the whole, the same sound all around, then he moves further up and tests it that way. And then he's got to test the drum to when he's put the ship skin on top of it. And more than that, he has also got to have this awareness that everything in the world has got life in it. And a woodcarver, before he does anything at all, in fact, when he's a child, he's taken up at the felling of the first tree. Find out that it's a living thing, so there's quite a to-do in the place. Libation is poured for the coming death of the tree, but at the same time, they wish that tree to relive in another form, become alive as a drum, to stir up more life and happiness and all the feelings that one gets at a happy dance, whether it's in the West or in Africa. That is done. Every bit of sheepskin or pegs used in a drum has got some ceremony performed with it. The woodcarver must know all that. Apart from that, as I told you, he must also have a fount or a whole catalogue of folk sayings, legends, to use in teaching his students or producing the right kind of mood in them. Very often too, they have got to learn to be expert dancers, and not only dancers but drummers at the same time. In the evenings, when he's got nothing much to do, he is able to meet with members of his own age group, both male and female. And very often you will find in African society, the old people have got their drums and their dances. They are mostly what we call court dances, associated with the chiefs. where the young people get together, form a club, and invent new drum forms all on their own, make up the songs themselves, and when they've had some practice and they think it is going very well, they then go to the most senior person in their precincts and ask him to become the patron of the dance club. If it takes on, you'll find other people adopting the same drum form, and very soon you'll find keen competition in the same drum form. Let us say Sichi. They'll select a certain day and come out about four contestants to find out who is the best Sichi drum group. That is taking the drumming side, the singing side, and the dancing side. I'm happy to say that these things still go on. In fact, after a short stay in Britain, when I went back home, I was very pleased that some of the boys I had taught at school felt that they should welcome me back, and I heard some drumming I had never heard before. I was indulging in something which at home is a necessity. When you travel and you come back, there's quite a to-do about that. It's a formal occasion where you ask all sorts of things. In the middle of all this, I heard this sound going out and I asked permission to go and see what was happening. And when I went, I was very pleased to see my boys. And then I found out that the name of the new dance, which had become quite popular in Ashanti, was called the Dance of the Tree of Sweet Remembrances. A very nice name and a very nice piece of drumming too. As I have been trying to tell you, most of these people do not specialize. They take an all-round view or training of things, and they are encouraged to do that. This does not apply only to wood carving, but to every one of the skills which is taught in Africa. But one of the most difficult arts, which you don't find in books, is what my teacher, traditional teacher, taught me. After giving me the history of this and that and all sorts of things, he told me that the last lesson was what he called the art of doing nothing. And it is quite a difficult thing, but this period of doing nothing takes a lot of learning, for it is a sort of contemplative mood subjectively induced to prepare the artist for inspiration for a new piece of creative expression. But when put in the vernacular, it just says the art of doing nothing. And I, from my experience of it, it's something which people need from time to time, to just get yourself into such a mood that you will be ready to catch any creative ideas which come. If I'm asked what is the creative, the motive source of African creativeness, I would say it is emotive and subjective, and appeals through the emotional level to the intellectual level. I want to make that distinction because I have also been trained on the Western a system of education in art, and my personal criticism is that people tend to approach art from an intellectual level and to try to communicate that at an intellectual level, and it finishes up to me looking like a piece of engineering. And that, I think, is what is wrong, because when you conceive the idea, even though you want to appeal to the intellect, you first of all take it with us through your emotion, the other person's emotion, and it will go up. As we say, mash it and pour it in and throw it in. It all ends in the cooking pot. So why bother? And that is a very important thing to remember about African art. As I repeat that, because there's another reason why so many books have been written about African sculpture, very often from an intellectual viewpoint, and the people have not tried to get behind the whole thing. I find the simplest way of doing, instead of reading all those books, is take hold of one of those photographs and take a good look at it for a long time, and you begin to get used to it. Find out a bit about the people, and you will begin to understand a lot more about it, and not just have it appeal to you because it's the way it's cut out in cubes, and the design of this is balanced up on that side there, and the way the asymmetric design has been balanced up by that bit of spatial design on that side. It gets you all confused, and the simple thing is, for example, I wanted to test some things out, so when I first saw a carving, a metal casting of the war god of the Dahomey people, who were next door neighbors to the people of my tribe, I was so intrigued by the intensity of this thing that I looked around for a painting of Mars. And I looked at the two things together, and with the memories I've had of what happened during the last war, I personally liked the interpretation of that Dahomey war god, because war is not a pleasant thing. And Mars, as I've seen him depicted in paint and even in sculpture, very often is a very athletic young chap, and it makes it look as if war is very pleasant. And for the same reason, I personally, of all the crucifixion pictures, like best Grunewald's interpretation of the crucifixion. It shows something more. All the other ones look, there's no suffering in it. It's very pretty. Does not appeal to me, but perhaps it is personal. But I look at it like an African, with emotion, seeing what is there, using the eye only to feel the thing, and then I begin to think about it. To show you that along with this kind of carving, sometimes you'll find in books that they say that they've carved the god looking terrible because they want to frighten the enemy. My friend over here will tell you that when you're going into war, you don't carry the god to the battlefield, because it's not a flag. If they take it and it's a powerful god, you've lost something. Nobody would think of taking a god to battle, and you find this in so many books. The real object is, one, to tell people not normally war is not a good thing. That intensity is there, and to back that, I can tell you nearly in every other African language, they've got songs similar to what we have got in our tribe. It says, there were 1,000 who left for the battle. 500 have not returned. Oh, mother, alas. 500 maidens await for those who will never come back. Alas, war is a bad thing. And you very often find out that is what is behind people's minds when they make that kind of carving. And another thing, here in your country, you put up scarecrows to scare the business. That sometimes you find that people also go to people's farms and pilfer things from there. In Africa, where the most part, except those who came from places influenced by the Mohammedans, there's no writing. What better form is there than to put down something frightening to tell people trespassers will be prosecuted, that sort of thing. When you go up to a place and you see a thing like that, then you get scared, you won't go there. It's as simple as that. The fact that it's got that expressiveness is because the person has got something which he wants to communicate. And I just want to tell you some of these things, because we have got a practical approach to art. We feel the thing and we use it for certain purpose, just to do the thing for its own sake. We don't believe in, but at the same time we feel very strongly about art, that we've got two words, very difficult to put that in English, but creation for creation which is of God, we use two sounds, body, but man makes things. Ye ade, ye means to do, make. But with God's, it's just to distinguish that in his case, it was not there and he made it. With man's case, it is there, he feels it, and more or less makes the same type of thing, two different things. Because they feel that the source also comes from the same creative spirit, who in this context is very often addressed as the great spider. They also talk about, if you want to say that this man is a first-class artist, I like his work. The way we say it in my tribe is that I like the objects which flow the spirit. I like the objects which fall from the tips of his fingers from the spirit of creation which flows along his arm. That sort of thing. But I haven't given you a rough idea of this because I'd like to come up to some other things which you can hear. I've just given you a broad outline of how we train our people, and we used to train our people, and also to explain to you why, if you found out very soon after each country in Africa has become independent and they've finished with a political reconstruction, they turn immediately to their art forms and their cultural forms, because every one of them has realized that that is the backbone. As they say at home, by all means run forward, but it is a good thing occasionally to stop and look behind you. That, for that, they use a carving, which is a bird striding forward, but with the head turned back. And for the same reason, we look back on this heritage to draw out new inspiration. And you'll find people are gathering things in museums. They are going around with tape recorders and recording as much music as possible. Other people, like my friends over here, the foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, they came up over there, saw me experimenting with dance forms, asked me to come over here because I told them that the greatest need we had in West Africa at the present moment was how very quickly to write as much of the dances down as possible, because I think in some few years' time we'll be able to come up here, don't mean my part of the world, but we'll be able to come up here and show you some new forms, new expressions of the dance. That is, if we can get the things down as quickly as possible. There has been danger in the past of these things going away because there wasn't very much encouragement in that direction from certain bodies. But now clubs have started all over the place, and old dances are being dug up, and you get hold of one of the old people, you remember about two or three dances, and the rhythm of the thing brings it out, you get the songs, you practice it, and then it begins to catch on. Those are some of the things which we in Africa would like to share with our friends here in America and in other parts of the world. We are trying to go back, but as I said, with some kind of discrimination. The old people taught us that things in one generation were the consensus of that which had passed with a bit of that which was present, and that to help the nation you had to add your bit to it. That is, in effect, don't take everything which is given to you in the past, because as they say, as the sun moves across the ceiling, which is the sky, then things too are changing. That comes from the same people who are sometimes looked upon as being conservative. When you get to understand the language and to know the people, you'll find very often that they're as progressive as any people. In fact, very often you'll find the old people more progressive than those of us who go to school. And when the Duchess of Kent came up to Ghana, at that time we hadn't got complete sway over things, and what they did was to have a fanfare and trumpets for her. just before I left Ghana to come here, I was very happy to find that at the presidential inauguration, everything was done in the African form. And the horn calls which were given to the biggest chief in Ghana, the Asantehene, were used for the ceremony. He sent his best trumpeters there. There were seven of them with great big elephant tusks held in this position in their full regalia. It was most colorful and the sound was really arresting. And apart from that, you see, the trumpets for fanfare in England, they just sound. And with ours, just as it is in drum language, which was something I forgot, we do not only teach people to speak properly, but we also try to teach them the language of the drums. It is made something which puzzles people, but it's just this. Our language, as I said, is tonal. And you usually, in some cases, have a tree or a box with two sounds, bam and dam. And you, by hitting very fast on that, you can imitate the rise and fall in the voice, and you get it. For example, Sante Kotoko, which is my tribe. If I'm going anywhere and I hear this at the beginning of a drum call, I know it's an Ashanti drummer calling, and he'll go ta-ta-ti-ta-ta-ta. Soon as I hear that, I begin to pay attention. And apart from that, it is very necessary for you to know that, because when you get into a circle to dance, the master drummer addresses you. If he knows you, he will start calling you, you so-and-so, descendant of a long line of warriors and so on. I have never held a gun in my life. But very often, when I go in, they begin to talk about all sorts of things. If you do not understand, you do not respond, and you will find that the drummers then begin to make remarks about you, and they go to town and have a very happy time talking about you. Sometimes, when you get in there, the first, if he doesn't know you, he says, and who may you be? You'll either dance and show him or make gestures to who you are, or you go up and tell him your name, and then he will know your family tree straight off. That's why I said it's very important in the training of even a drummer. He's got to know all these things, and the mention of one name, and he knows what family the person comes from, and gives out the whole of the family history and what they've done for the nation. And it is very important, because especially with some of the modern people who hold high positions, coming back to the dancing, we can teach them the dance very quickly. But drum language, they sometimes don't bother to learn, and he starts dancing, and then all this thing starts. There's the one or two points I just want to run through this very quickly before I give you some sounds, because I didn't bring any sculptures or pictures, because I think you've seen many here in the library, but you don't very often see here African music. There's this which I want to explain. I may be wrong, but to me, watching dances here and in Britain and in other parts of Europe, I've noticed that dancers here dance to the melodic line. If the song is going pa-ta-ta-ta, pa-ta-ta-ta, invariably you'll find out that the steps are just like that. Or the pa-ta-ta-ta, the ta-ta-ta, you might do a long pause on it, but they follow the same kind of line. In Africa, they do a very curious thing, which I must confess, I hadn't noticed until I came here. I had to move away from home to this place in order to find out. You see, when you get exposed to something else, you begin to think things out. That's why I think this conference is a very good thing, because I had to come up here to realize it. At home you find, as you will soon find out, they will be singing a song along a certain line, and the person will be dancing something not in keeping with that at all. He's dancing to the drums, the rhythm. And the melodic line is really to set a mood, because the same drum form, if it's a dua drum, it will have different songs, but about different moods it, one may be talking about death, in which case, if you're taking progressive walking steps and it's talking about death, you take longer strides and you just let yourself go on each one of them. But if he's talking about something gay or about, when we were young, then for the same step you prance more and you do jumps in it. So that's the distinguishing thing. And then there is this. Sometimes you listen to the whole texture of the drums, and at other times you listen in for one particular drum and begin to dance to that. That's how we make up our sequences. You just listen to one drum. It may be just the equivalent of the triangle going kank, 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 and you try to move with that. Moving from that, you go up to the short drum or the long drum or the master drum itself. Another thing I'd like to point out to you, some people who've been out to Africa and seen dancers, they just listened and said, isn't it a bit monotonous? They have not listened long enough to distinguish the textural changes. In any art form, you find there are conventions. It took me a long time to understand why your operatic tenor doesn't die when he's mortally wounded and he goes on singing. But after getting over that, I've begun to enjoy the opera very much, but it always looks very funny to me. And now I sort of enjoy it because I've accepted and assimilated the convention, so it's easy. It's the same kind of thing with any art form in any other part of the world. And I'm mentioning some of these things so that when you see Africans dancing, you'll be able to appreciate it more. And in that context, I want you to watch out very carefully for a lot of things going on now in New York, passing to be African dances. I saw a program of dancers, 12 dancers. It was performed somewhere, I didn't see it myself, but when I tried to look out for who the person was, he had never been to Africa. He was a West Indian, and he got a program, an all-African program of dances, and one of the things which shook me was that he said there was a dance of spears among a certain tribe which does not exist in South Africa. And I have been to see some of these things, and you see, unfortunately, some people here in America have got a concept of what certain things should be like. And the people have found out, and they give them what they think you want. I have, since I've been here, had one trouble with a person who wanted me to put on a show, and he wanted me to do something. I said, we don't do it. I said, what you're saying is so completely new to me. He said, that's what America wants. I said, no. America wants to see authentic African dances. When they've seen the authentic African dances, they may want to borrow some ideas from it. What they make of that will be the American's understanding or reinterpretation or adaptation within his own setup and within his dance technique. But I am not going to make up something, give it to the Americans and say that's how they should do it. We didn't get on, but the second lot of people understood it and we were able to put on a good show. I mention this because there is a great danger there of you being taken in by a whole lot of things which are supposed to be African and are not. I think I've said enough, and I just want to say this. We suffer from two things, written language has just been introduced. People ask me, is your language written? When you say, what do they look like? We use phonetic script now, and young people everywhere are making some attempt to write short plays as a sort of preparation for something bigger. At anticipated, it hasn't been done before. We were not in a position to do it. We did not rule ourselves. Now we do. We are making use of the dramatic situations which exist even to this day, the chiefs Durbans, the fetish dance, which to me is the most dramatic dance. You go in there, they spend about 7 years learning how to do that dance. And to watch it is as moving as anything you can think of. And their very art of storytelling is something very specialized. And I would like to see that there was, and I think it still exists in certain parts of Africa, a certain convention when stories are being told, and a storyteller goes on for a long time just playing with words, and there's no sort of song in his story, you will find some of the audience, his listeners, would leave. And after a bit, you hear from the other end, hold your tail. Then the storyteller says, I'm holding it. And they will begin to enact a situation out of a completely different story, but which has got a song. And as they say that part, the rest of the people here then become like a Greek chorus. They join in with them, singing the songs, and these people act the part of the old woman and the dog or that sort of thing. And they act up until they come up to the place. Everybody has a good laugh, and then they continue. And that is the form we want to get to and to develop. I think when we've done it, if we do it properly, it will start like the comic theater in France and Italy. And we feel that that's where we ought to start. With art forms, you can't jump the tracks. You just got to start with what you've got and not try to use Shakespeare as your model right from the very start. It's impossible. So I think at this stage, I would like to end this part by saying something which we say at home at the end of storytelling. I have told my tale. You may like some part of it, you may not like some part of it, but whatever you feel, take some away and bring me something back. This is an example of the kind of poetry which is shouted by the, or declaimed by the court attendant, the chief executioner, when the Santihini is about to enter his palace. they try to be as much of a nuisance as possible. Because after a very long day, when he's at last retiring into his palace, they want to keep him away from the house to express their, well, another concept of our feeling of democracy, that even the common person can stop the king. So they go on chanting this, and the ruling is that he must not walk while he is being acclaimed. So he just stands like this, and these people just keep on. Sometimes you see him actually begging them with his eyes to let him go, and he just takes one or two steps, and then they come on again.
I'm worthy. Was that a good note? A good note of money? And my mom and mother come. Well, come by the Albert Dunga. One day.
A short example. You don't need to understand the language to know it's poetry. And that last bit there, it says there's something moving in the thicket. What's in the thicket? It is the white one, the striped one, or the spotted one in this case. It says, and he is restless, so is his tail. And he is in danger, who disturbs him? He is in danger of his life, who makes his tail to wave in the air. That is there. It's no, one must not try to annoy the Ashanti nation, whose head is the Ashanti king, whose symbol of office is referred to very often as the spotted leopard. These are also courtiers chanting in the same kind of vein, but it's a sort of sing-song version of it. That is
Thank you.